welcome to the World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now, news and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is March 1st, 2017, and your host is Teresa Sims. Hey, Teresa, take us back 100 years ago this week.
Thanks, Teo, and thanks to our audience for joining us today. I'm coming to you live from Washington, D.C., the Centennial Headquarters, and let's go back 100 years ago this week. After months of ongoing carnage at the Somme, Prime Minister Lloyd George has become very dissatisfied with Douglas Haig's performance. He was, however, impressed by the French commander, General Neville. So on February 27th, George proposed that all Allied armies in France be placed under Neville's command. Follow the link in the chat room to find out how the British generals reacted. Now, there's another interesting event that happened this week 100 years ago. It involves President Wilson's response to Germany's U-boat campaign. Here to talk more about it is Mike Schuster from the Great War Project. Mike?
Hi, Teresa. Well, the headlines could read, "Pressure on U.S. intensifies. Wilson to Congress. I am a man of peace. But U.S. must arm American ships. The slow, slow creep in U.S. to war." And this is special to the Great War Project. With President Woodrow Wilson's decision to break diplomatic relations with Germany a century ago, debate about possible American entry into the war intensifies. Debate about the war did not cease, of course, writes historian Michael Kazin. Lawmakers from both American political parties delivered passionate speeches for and against taking new and aggressive actions to punish Germany. Interventionist newspapers like the New York Times, reports Kazin, predicted a swift economic decline if transatlantic shipping did not resume soon. The Germans had begun to attack U.S. merchant ships, and soon there are American casualties. But still, President Wilson is not prepared to declare war. Unless the president changed his mind, reports Kazin, the anxious status quo might last, as the departing German ambassador hoped. The German ambassador is preparing to leave the United States after the break in relations. Privately, Wilson is moving closer to taking the U.S. into the war. Writes Kazin, by mid-February, Wilson had privately arrived at a decision he knew carried the risk of war. The United States would place guns powerful enough to sink a submarine on merchant vessels bound for Europe. For the president, this armed neutrality was a middle course between letting the Germans have their way on the high seas and joining the Allies. And in addition, reports historian Kazin, it would also, Wilson hoped, appease shipping companies who were seeing their profits rotting away on domestic wharves. Before announcing it, Wilson told the members of his cabinet he wanted to seek the approval of Congress, although his advisors assured him he had the legal power to act without it. So, on February 26, precisely a century ago, Wilson unveiled the idea before a joint session of Congress. Writes Kazin, he shrewdly appealed both to national self-interest and to the strong desire of most Americans to avoid war. He acknowledged that no U-boat had yet torpedoed an American ship of any size. Wilson tells Congress he is committed to maintaining his policy of neutrality. I'm anxious, he declares, that the people of the nations at war also should understand and not mistrust us. I am the friend of peace, Wilson says, and mean to preserve it for America so long as I am able. Wilson tells Congress even now he is not proposing or contemplating war or any steps that need lead to it. In asking Congress to authorize funds for arming merchant ships, he referred vaguely to other instrumentalities or methods that might be needed to protect our ships and our people in their legitimate and peaceful pursuit on the seas. Kazin praises the president. No previous speech Wilson had delivered about the Great War was greeted so favorably and by such disparate voices. Newspapers loyal to both parties and supporting either intervention or peace all praised his wisdom, his logical and reasonable appeal, and his honor and courage. But a few voiced suspicions that some of the language in the speech might be a backhanded way of preparing the nation for a declaration of war. Still, most in the United States believe that the speech is designed to maintain Wilson's neutrality policy to keep the United States out of the war. And that's where things stand with the United States at this point 100 years ago.
Thank you, Mike. And that is Mike Schuster with the Great War Project, and he is guiding us through the days leading up to U.S. entry into war on April 6th. Now, let's find out what's happening this week in the skies over Europe in today's War in the Sky segment. Teo, take it away.
100 years ago this week, the story of the Great War in the Sky involves Navy Lieutenant Kenneth Whiting. It was this week, 100 years ago, that he proposed to the United States Secretary of the Navy, Joseph Daniels, that the Navy acquire a ship with an aircraft catapult and a flight deck, prompting the first serious U.S. Navy consideration of such an acquisition. Whiting was a visionary who had started even a year prior in 1916 to campaign for the U.S. Navy development of what was then called plane carriers. He was always a visionary who started his naval career as a pioneer in submarines, but in 1914, his request to become an aviator was granted, and he reported to the Wright Company in Dayton, Ohio, to learn how to fly. In fact, he was the last naval officer to take flight training directly from Orville Wright. All right, so in March, he proposed the first sort of aircraft carrier. In April, America declares war. In May, Whiting is selected to command the 1st Naval Air Unit. He, seven officers, and 122 enlisted men board ships to cross the Atlantic to France, becoming the first officers and men of the regular fighting forces of the United States to land in France. This was reported on June 8th in the official bulletin, published daily under the order of the President by the Committee for Public Information, a very interesting U.S. war bulletin. Well, what about the carrier proposal? So, 2 weeks after he and his men arrive in France, the Navy rejected the idea. Bummer. And Whiting had to wait until 1922 when he was made commanding officer of the U.S.'s first actual aircraft carrier, the CV-1 USN Langley. But that quest began 100 years ago this week for the Great War in the Sky.
And that's Teo Meyer with the War in the Sky, and it's fantastic as always. Now, to get more information about what was going on 100 years ago, the Great War Channel might be a good place to look. Today we have three new episodes. The first one is The Outbreak of World War I. It's a banker's perspective. Second is Austro-Hungarian Heroes. And the third, Mechanized War in Mesopotamia. World War I now. This week, John Jack D. Monaghan of Essex, Connecticut, was sworn in as a commissioner to the United States World War I Centennial Commission during the American Legion's Legislative Midwinter Conference held in D.C. He was appointed to this position by the American Legion. He has served the Legion in the past as commander of La Place Champlain, American Legion Post 18 in Essex, Connecticut. And he's also served in various posts and also at the state and national levels. He's a wonderful, wonderful addition to the commission, and I know he's going to serve the American Legion well. We're going to change gears here and move on to the World War I Now section of our show. Let's start out by looking ahead at the commission's activities and events calendars. So there's the first one I've chosen is San Diego and the Great War, 1914 to 1919. This is going to be the Congress of History of San Diego and Imperial Counties in the San Diego Veterans Museum at Balboa Park. They're co-sponsoring a two-day conference commemorating the role the Greater San Diego region played during the war. They'll talk about the war and the aftermath, which were the catalysts that contributed to the region's development into a major modern U.S. naval base. Our next selection is from Arkansas, and it's a festival celebrating Arkansas women's contribution and experiences during World War I. It will occur on Saturday, March 4th from 10 to 2, and it will be at the Little Rock Arthur Museum of Arkansas Military History. And our third selection is World War I and the Red Cross. It's a lunch and learn, and the reason I selected this one is this one features Dr. Julia F. Irwin at the Florida Historic Capitol Museum, but it is in celebration of American Red Cross Month, which begins in March. And in this particular presentation, historian and author Julia Irwin speaks about the importance of the Red Cross during World War I, and she's also signing copies of her acclaimed book, Making the World Safe, The American Red Cross and a Nation's Humanitarian Awakening. For more ideas on types of commemorative activities and points of contact, you can always look at our events calendar for more information. Now, moving to our states. The Alabama Commission has made an interesting announcement on their site. The Alabama Department of Archives and History has made approximately 100 World War I posters available online in its digital archives. There are wonderful, colorful, striking graphics, and their fascinating patriotic symbolism can now be appreciated by anyone with an internet connection. This is great for classrooms, for post programs. Copies of the posters can be downloaded at no charge from the site. It's great news, not for just the people of Alabama, but the entire World War I commemoration community. Last week, we announced that the Colorado State Commission's website went live. This week, we are very fortunate to be joined by Philip Sneed, their executive director at the Arvada Center for the Arts and Humanities and the chair of the Colorado World War I Centennial Steering Committee. Philip, tell us about how Colorado is commemorating World War I and a little bit about your steering committee. I understand it had a very unusual genesis.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on. The Arvada Center for the Arts and Humanities is located in Arvada, which is a suburb of Denver. And we're a 40-year-old multidisciplinary arts and humanities organization and one of the largest multidisciplinary arts organizations in the country. And we're always looking for stories to tell that can take both the arts and the humanities to tell stories through different lenses. And a few years ago, we decided to do something around World War I, or specifically around the U.S. involvement from April of 17 to November of 18. So we started putting together a series of a steering committee with several partners in the throughout Colorado, and began to put together a series of arts and humanities events. And we only, in the last few months, became aware of the Centennial Commission's work and decided to offer ourselves as the unofficial state commission. Rather than going through the difficult political process in our state of being officially designated, we're taking this on in an unofficial capacity. But we are coordinating events that we are producing and presenting around the state, but we are also making ourselves available and our webpage available and our staff available to help to publicize the events that others might be doing throughout the state. We're partnering with organizations such as Colorado Humanities, which is the state humanities agency, the Center for the Study of War Experience at Regis University, the Denver Film Society, Metro State University, the VFW Post Number 1, the very first one in the country, which was established, I think, in 1898. We'll be working with them as well. And some of the highlights of what we're doing all of the usual. We're doing a lecture series. We're doing a series of presentations by Chautauquans who portray characters from the time period, and then after a short presentation, they answer questions in character. So we've got coming up, for example, Jeanette Rankin and Theodore Roosevelt. We're doing a series of exhibitions in our galleries, including an exhibition of posters of World War I. We're also partnering with the Money Museum in Colorado Springs, which is part of the American Numismatic Association on monies and coins and medals of World War I. And we're also curating an exhibit called Art in Conflict, Contemporary Perspectives on Conflict, where we're putting out a call for entries for artists whose work deal with war in some form or another. We're partnering with the Denver Film Society on a series of seven films about the war, starting 11-11-17 with the film of All Quiet on the Western Front, and ending on 11-11-18 with the film of the stage musical Oh, What a Lovely War. And we're trying to look at these projects through a variety of different lenses. Take All Quiet on the Western Front, for example. We'll be doing several libraries throughout the state are going to be doing a series of book discussion groups, and one of the books is All Quiet on the Western Front. Then we'll also be showing the film of All Quiet, and then we'll have a lecture by historian Patricia Limerick on All Quiet on the Western Front. So we're trying to look at these events and cultural artifacts of the war from a variety of different perspectives. We're also doing three different performances called War on Words, in which actors who are on contract for us will be portraying some of the poets of World War I, both American and British poets. And they'll be acting out the debate that went on in the pages of Poetry Magazine about should the U.S. become involved or should the U.S. not. And poets were on both sides of that issue, so we'll have opposing poets bringing those words to life. So those are some of the kinds of things that we're doing over the next 19 months.
That's awesome. And hats off to you and to the all the members of your committee. And I love the idea. It sounds like a poetry slam from 100 years ago. And so yeah. This is very intriguing. Thank you very much for coming to visit with us today.
Thank you very much.
From our international report, we have a headline out of the UK that reads, Tunnel Network reveals how First World War I sappers battled beneath the Western Front as their comrades fought in the trenches above. There's a new book out called Beneath the Killing Fields by Matthew Leonard. This book documents the lives of special engineering soldiers known as sappers. So what are sappers? Sappers were mainly former coal miners drafted in from the pits. This article has some really interesting images of the tunnels, the diggers, and what was above ground and what was below ground, and what remains of it today. We encourage you to check it out. The link is in the chat room. Next, we have some new posts and articles to bring to your attention. We have an interview posted on our site with Commissioner Monique Seyfried about the upcoming April 6 event in Kansas City. She's been a regular lecturer on World War I, its causes and its consequences. She talks with us about the event, the significance of World War I, and why the decision by the U.S. to enter the war is so important to commemorate. She has a lot of insights as to why we got involved. Next, we have an interview featuring historian and author Robert Laplander. Robert is working on a new book about the Lost Battalion's unit commander, Charles Whittlesey. He's been involved with a highly anticipated PBS American Experience series called The Great War. In addition to all that, Robert's been researching for his Doughboy MIA section of the World War I Centennial Commission website. Follow the link to see more of what this author's been up to. On 100 Cities and 100 Memorials this week, learn more about Kevin Fitzpatrick's World War I Memorial Restoration Project on Governor's Island in New York. Kevin is a highly active World War I commemoration advocate, and he submitted the grant application to the 100 Cities, 100 Memorial program. We're proud to shine a light on his fantastic efforts and this project. On our W. Wright blog, we have a post where actor-writer Daryl Dillard talks about the Great War's influence for black male actors today. When the nation joined the war, blacks volunteered in droves to prove loyalty to the country and gain respect. They fought not only their enemies, but also centuries of negative stereotypes that had become commonplace in American media. This is a great read. Don't miss it. Our last post comes from our Stories of Service section. This week, there's a short post on David Gaines Gentry, Jr. David, like so many other young men of the time, had never ventured far from his hometown. But when the call to arms came, he took up a cause greater than himself, and he traveled across the globe to fight for it. Take a moment to read about this brave man by clicking on the link in the chat room. All right, now, moving on to the buzz. Let's see what's going on in the world of social media. Kathy Akey, are you with us? I am so excited to hear what you have picked for us on the social media conversation wall.
Hi, yes, good afternoon. It has been a really wonderful month for social media because it's been Black History Month, and now that it's March, we're moving into Women's History Month. So I'm really excited to feature for the month of March a lot of stories and photos of women doing their part during World War I. Some interesting articles from the past week. We have an article from Time.com that goes through how African American soldiers were recruited for World War I and plugs the upcoming PBS documentary, The Great War, that's going to be released this April. And we're really looking forward to seeing that. Tying back into the new book that's being released about sappers, Dr. Jeff Guskey, who is a friend of the commission, has an extremely interesting looking exhibit opening with the Smithsonian soon. He photographs in the underground tunnels and bunkers from World War I, mostly the sort of sketched in names and drawings and jokes that soldiers left behind. The images are really interesting, and it would be well worth everyone's time to check it out. Additionally, we're really excited at the National Air and Space Museum. There's going to be a film series coming up soon. Hollywood Goes to War, World War One on the Big Screen, which we'll post more about as it comes. They're playing a number of interesting movies like The Dawn Patrol, The Fighting 69th, Hell's Angels, and All Quiet on the Western Front. So if you can't make it out to Colorado, there'll be a showing of that here in D.C. as well. And finally, I wanted to point out a really interesting article in The Atlantic by Ellen Hampton about World War One and medicine. We all know that war creates a lot of speed for the development of technology, and medicine is included in that. It's a very interesting article. There's a lot of really cool pictures, and I would encourage people to check those out.
Thanks, Kathy. Wonderful. Well, with that, we are at the end of our show. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day and for joining us and for all your hard work. And so with that, I sign off and see you next week.
World War One Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War One Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The videos can be found at www.ww1cc.org/cn. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, The Weekly Dispatch. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at WW1CC and on Facebook at WW1Centennial. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to commemorate. So long.